Good morning, Ottawa. This is the Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
The Morning Rush. Good morning, Wednesday. Short work week. We're halfway through a 4-day week. I guess halfway is yesterday when you're done. So we're into the second half now. Good morning, and thanks for being here. Yesterday, the former head of OC Transpo, John Manconi, was on the stand for the LRT inquiry, and this is a big week. The mayor is taking the stand tomorrow. We've got a couple city councilors on the stand today, and he was asked a lot about political interference. Was there political interference to meet some of those deadlines? We constantly heard it, right? On time, on budget, was there political interference to make sure we reach one of those deadlines? And he was speaking with lawyer John Adair and pushed back on the claim that he was prepared to work with RTG to adjust some of the criteria to help get stage two.
I'm going to suggest to you that what happened is, as you saw on August 7th, that you were starting to slide back into days that were bad. And as you saw that even the days that were passes were horrendous, what you did is you suggested to RTG that you could get them a pass by reverting to the old criteria, as long as they were prepared to help you out on stage two.
Absolutely not. I totally disagree with that.
And if Mr. Lloyd says that that's what happened, you disagree with him?
I disagree with that 100%.
There were a lot of questions, remember, in the lead up to it with, one, if they were just trying to meet an arbitrary deadline just for the sake of saying that they were on time because of pressure. But then the other one that I had was 12 days of testing. It was supposed to be 12 days of uninterrupted, no issue testing, and we could never get an answer on whether or not that was actually achieved. Here's another exchange between that lawyer and Manconi.
It says the scorecard for today will be addressed in the committee meeting tomorrow at 2 p.m., but we are expecting a fail, meaning a restart from day one. We tried to make a case for a repeat as opposed to a restart, another favor we need from the client. So RTG was putting pressure on you to do them favors and score things differently, right?
No.
They were not asking you for favors?
They were not asking me to score differently.
Were they asking the city to score differently?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know what that sentence means.
Okay. So there's that. And he reiterated the claim that he says there was no political pressure to get the system launched on time.
No pressure coming your way from elected officials to get this thing done in the summer of 2019. That's your evidence.
That is my evidence. There was a lot of asks, a lot of disappointments with missed deadlines, a lot of people that were anxious, but there was no political pressure to get it done by a certain date exerted on me.
And I mean, at this point, you're only taking his word for it, right? When it comes down to something like this, I'm less concerned about the political pressure than I am about what happened with the 12 days, the restart, as opposed to, just resetting a certain day. I've still got questions about that weren't answered yesterday. One of the other things that came down that had some people upset was the fact that instead of doing a full briefing to City Hall, they would just have a WhatsApp group with Manconi and the mayor and a couple other key figures at City Hall, but not kind of a full briefing. And to me, that just kind of plays into that narrative of the inner circle at City Hall getting all the information when instead of a full public briefing, which loses track of the fact that this is a public project. There's a lot of taxpayer money put into this, and city council should be getting updates. Now, should they be updated absolutely every day on this? Or should it just be kind of scheduled updates, and should there be no updates in between? And I'm not sure that there should be absolutely no updates to key people at City Hall in between. So a lot of people are jumping up and down, pointing at the WhatsApp group as being a problem. Maybe WhatsApp isn't the best place to do your city communication in, but an update to just key figures instead of calling back city council every single day for a full update actually does kind of make some sense to me. Right? Are you really going to, but maybe it's better instead of a WhatsApp chat to sit down, put out a memo to the entire city council and give them an update. Now, part of his testimony yesterday, John Manconi said the city, he had drafted a memo at some point. The city manager told him, well, remember, we said we weren't going to do any updates on these 12 days of testing. So there's no need to give a memo about anything that's gone wrong. Okay. Fair enough, I guess, if you said you weren't going to do it. But if you decide to update some people, should you be sending a memo to everyone at City Hall instead of a WhatsApp chat? Maybe you should just be having the meeting and briefing just a few key figures there. But there were some interesting things coming out of that meeting, and we'll talk more about it in about 20 minutes time with CTV's Graham Richardson, who was all over this yesterday covering that situation. Pretty crazy time yesterday in Saanich, British Columbia. There was a pretty small town bank, the Bank of Montreal, but you can tell just from the video outside, it would have looked like what you'd see many small town bank branches to be, a bit of an older building in a more quiet area of a town. And two bank robbery suspects who were believed to have been wearing body armor, dead, and six police officers injured after what went down there yesterday. And there was social media video of the bank robbery, and it showed the police officers kind of running towards the bank building and starting to fire. And you just see gunshots being exchanged. And the two, it seemed like there were two voices behind the camera. It was just cell phone footage. And it seemed to be like there was one guy holding it up and there was probably somebody beside him. And they were just both kind of yelling and swearing the whole time, being like, we're witnessing a bank robbery right now. This is unbelievable. The two suspects are dead. Some of the police officers have serious injuries. And that's really all the information we have on that right now. Six officers shot. The chief constable in Saanich is Dean Duthie. Says police got a call around 11 a.m. that morning about two armed suspects who entered a Bank of Montreal branch in that town.
Multiple officers responded to the scene and encountered the armed suspects who fired at police. Two suspects who were shot by police died at the scene.
Now, amazingly, nobody who worked at the bank or no members of the public were hurt.
There's three officers that are looking to be released from hospital probably in the next little while. The others that are undergoing surgery right now obviously have much more serious injuries. And at this point, I just can't comment on the extent or nature of them because it's ongoing.
Yeah, very scary situation. And at the time yesterday when he spoke to the media, the chief there said there may have been a third suspect at large, but they weren't sure about that yet.
It's not a confirmed third suspect, but we're taking all safety precautions necessary. We've asked all those areas around the bank incident to remain in their houses, lock their doors, what we call shelter in place. And we've taken all the necessary precautions to get the information out through media channels, through our social media, to keep the public up to date.
When we saw some social media activity first yesterday about it, you see a small town bank robbery. I mean, it's a town or a city of 119,000 people, so not the smallest town in the world, but not very large either. And you see, you know, bank robbery in the town, and I don't know what I was expecting, but it wasn't what ended up coming down. And like I said, six officers hurt, three fairly seriously, so hoping the best for them. And that video is available on social media, but There's no point in playing the sound of it there because all it would be is sensors. Because the guy who's taking the video was clearly in shock at what he was seeing and just swearing every second word. And I don't really blame him for that because I'm not even sure that I would be taking that video at that point. I'd probably just be getting as far away from there as I can. He was far enough away across the street, but you could see a full view of the bank. Very, very crazy stuff in small town British Columbia yesterday. It's the Morning Rush. Good morning.
It's been 60 business days since Daisy ordered her passport.
And no end in sight for that as of yesterday. Still no passport delivered. So the countdown continues. It's been almost 2 weeks since I asked for an update and was told it would be 3 business days. And a lot of you texting in 580-580 with very similar interactions with the passport office. Couple things here. One is a letter to the editor in the Globe and Mail that caught my attention on social media here. Raphael Girard, retired assistant deputy minister responsible for Passport Canada, he made a point that it really doesn't take all that much for people to deal with the delays in getting a passport renewal. Expired passports can be extended with a simple endorsement on the observation page for a period of perhaps 1 year to spread the renewal load over the next 12 months and let Canadians who expect adequate levels of service take sorely needed vacations. I understand that some of the opposition here has been painted as this is some kind of first world problem. But at the root of it, what this is failure of government to give you ID that you're entitled to. And when you play 60, when you say 60 business days, at the end of this week, it'll be 13 weeks since I applied for it. Listen, I've got nowhere to go. People think I'm using this chair sitting here and trying to get a quicker passport. A quicker passport is not going to do me any good. Our family's expecting a new baby in the next couple of weeks. That baby's not going to be born in a foreign country. I'm not leaving. Don't need the passport. I'm just using it to point out just how incompetent this has become. 13 weeks is ridiculous to get it there. And, you know, you're blaming people for waiting too long on booking travel with expired documents. And most of the people that I'm talking to whose passport, it's not like, hey, I want to leave tomorrow. My passport's expired. What do I do? No, it's I want to leave in 3 months. My passport's expired. That should be plenty of time to go out there and get a new one. What are we going to do about it? 2 months ago today, my credit card was charged and nothing was done about it. Still no passport. That's not an acceptable level of service. So there's that. The public safety minister, Marco Mendicino, said earlier this week that he foresees the ArriveCan app being used past the pandemic to speed up your customs interactions. You fill out all your information, you show it quickly, you move on. Here's my question about that, though. Has he talked to anybody who works as a customs and immigration official, like the guy we talked to, you heard it earlier this morning, that said, hey, so much of our time here is spent correcting forms that were filled out incorrectly or telling people that they had to do it because they didn't know that they had to use it. And it just seems like it's going to be a total nightmare. How hard is it really to cross the border most times? The wait is long. I understand that. And sometimes you have issues. But most times, let's say you're in your car. You drive up there. You've got 3 people in your car. You hand them 3 passports. You roll the windows down. They do a quick look. Why are you here? What are you doing? Pass you back your passports and you go. Is that not what the majority of interactions are at that crossing? I'm not saying there aren't some times where they spot some kind of issue, right? You maybe you're blinking too much or you're holding the steering wheel a little tightly and you look a bit suspicious and you get more questions and maybe you're asked to pull over. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but the majority of border crossing experiences would be like that. What exactly are we trying to speed up from that through fumbling around with your phone, right? It's like, yeah, I know it's here somewhere. Let me find this. Oh, ignore that. That's my girlfriend texting me. My wife's there. I don't want her to see that. So I got to swipe it up, right? Like you're trying to solve a problem that doesn't really exist here. If you want to use ArriveCan past this pandemic, we should be talking about removing it completely, not about expanding its use. Only this government would look at the complete incompetence that's been going on here and think, ah, maybe we can do this for longer. Well, the rest of us are saying this is getting a bit ridiculous. We need to find some kind of way to move past that. And while we're talking about travel and while we're talking about delays, I saw a CTV story this morning. I guess they did the story yesterday about Nexus cards. And if your Nexus card is either expired or you want to get a new one, you have to do the in-person interview at the Nexus office, right? Well, did you know that Canadian Nexus offices still aren't open? So any Canadian who wants a Nexus card needs to do the interview, has to get to the U.S. to do those in-person interviews somewhere else. They interviewed this woman out of Toronto who wants her Nexus card. The craziest, let's ignore the fact that she said she applied for it in 2019, because we'll say, okay, that's just a bit unlucky. A pandemic hit a few months later. Things went a bit sideways. But now things are reopened on the U.S. side, and she has to go to Niagara Falls, New York, to do her Nexus interview, because apparently we haven't reopened the Nexus offices here in Canada. No one seems to know why either. CTV reached out to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and all they said was at this time enrollment centers in Canada will remain closed. So is that a Canadian decision? Is that an American decision? It didn't really seem to be clear from this, and CTV couldn't get a straight answer from it. They end the story with saying it's not clear why Nexus offices in Canada remain closed, and they've been open in the U.S. since April. But figure it out. These aren't crazy asks to be able to get an ID to leave the country. And we need to figure this out and get a bit of a better system going on, because right now they're telling you if you're going in to apply for a passport, they've totally just lowered the bar completely. They're just like 9 to 11 weeks. That's where you're at. So they went from saying the majority of people will get it within 40 business days, which I think is already very long, but that's 8 weeks. They went from saying that a couple of weeks ago to now on their website saying expect it in 9 to 11. They're not even trying to meet that insane 40-day guideline that they set forward a few weeks ago. Now they've just realized that's not even there. They're saying 9 to 11 weeks. I'm closing in on 13, but 2 months since I've been charged. Maybe it'll come today. Who knows? It's the Morning Rush.
It's been 60 business days since Daisy ordered her passport. You're listening to the Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
It's Matt Harrison for Bill Carroll, The Morning Rush. The former head of OC Transpo, John Manconi, testified yesterday at the Ottawa Light Rail Transit Public Inquiry. And a lot to go through there. Someone who's been covering the ups and downs of Ottawa's light rail transit from the beginning is CTV's Graham Richardson. He's on the line. Graham, thanks for being here this morning. Appreciate it.
No problem, Matt.
What was your main takeaway yesterday from John Manconi? There was a bit that we could dive into there, but for you, what was the biggest surprise, or maybe not surprise, but biggest takeaway?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is that, first of all, for the inquiry, the public is getting a view of the secrecy that enveloped the city. And like RTG, the operator, was not allowed to talk to the media unless it was approved by the city. And the only people speaking really were Manconi, the mayor, and a couple of councillors with knowledge. So for years now, it's been very frustrating to figure out exactly what was going on. And what the inquiry has done is cracked open the critical months leading up to the launch in September of 2019. And what was going on was, from a certain perspective, and it's clear the commission lawyers are painting a picture that the system was not even close to being ready, and potentially the launch was rushed. Now, the city is pushing back, suggesting that they hit their marks. But yesterday was a very, very rough day on the stand for John Manconi.
The 12 days of testing comes up a lot in this inquiry. What was the rules? Like, as I remember, it had to be 12 uninterrupted days of successful running for it to meet the criteria. Was that right?
Pretty much. And they couldn't hit it. And
yeah.
For the first 11 days, they got four passes. So then the decision was, the city lawyer suggested to Manconi yesterday, well, you had to be tough but flexible on the testing. And so they hit 9 days. And then we all were there on the launch. And then another critical point is when the buses came off and the full system was on full load. That's when the significant problems started. There are two stories here, Matt. The story from RTG, the manufacturer, Alstom, arguably, and maybe the commission seems to be that rushed story and political pressure and the city not understanding, generally speaking, that a mega project like this will have many delays and you can't hit hard dates regardless of the political pressure. And the other side, and so the city will take a lot of blame. The other side of the story is we hit our marks. It wasn't a safety issue. They did very well in testing, and we had to work these bugs out, and we were working these bugs out. We haven't got yet to, there hasn't been a lot about the actual derailments that shut the system down for an entire month, which obviously was much more serious. And that will likely, when they get there, will likely put RTM under more of a microscope. And Peter Lauch is testifying this morning. So some significant testimony coming up today as well.
So on the political pressure standpoint, Manconi was adamant yesterday that that just did not exist. He said basically there were tough questions and people wanted answers, but there was no political pressure.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear that the commission lawyer kept coming back at that, generally speaking, and Manconi pushed back right away saying, no, I never had political pressure. I guess it's your definition of what is political pressure. When you're in a WhatsApp chat with the mayor and the chair of the council, chair of the transit commission, and you're making key decisions on testing, on other things, and you're only speaking to them, it'll be interesting to see what, during the mayor's testimony, what he was doing during the testing time. And look, the other thing you got to remember too, everywhere Jim Watson went at this time in our city, everywhere he went, the question was, when's it going to open? When's it going to open? When's it going to open? Because it had been delayed and delayed. And there have been four missed delays. And they did not hit their marks. And the city officials, several of them, including Manconi, talked about the fact that on the ground, Michael Morgan the other day saying, on the ground, we were seeing things that were not matching what RTG was telling us in meetings, meaning the stations weren't ready. And the message from RTG was always, don't worry, we've got it in hand, we're going to hit it, we're going to make it. And then they would miss, right? So it's your definition of political pressure. There was political pressure because the public was like, is this thing ever going to run? The question is, did that influence the choice to go ahead with the launch? And is the commission going to find, is the judge going to find that there was this pressure and this was a factor and they should have held back and they should have done more trial runs or whatever it was? The system wasn't ready.
What do you make of this WhatsApp group? Should all of council been updated at times? It seems interesting to me that WhatsApp was the choice of communication. I think you can maybe make a case for only updating the mayor and some key people on there, but should it have been done in different channels other than an app that you use to text your buddies as well?
Well, and the overall context here is it's not exactly a massive flow of information to council. Later this afternoon, councillors are going to testify that, and I guarantee you they'll testify, it was very, very difficult to get any information out. I'm not sure they knew there was a WhatsApp group. The other interesting thing is that the city didn't right away disclose the WhatsApp texts. Now, why is that? And the commission had to fight to get them, is my understanding. And so they've got them released now, and they're going through them with a fine-tooth comb. I don't think it's particularly unusual that there's a discussion between senior people. And, I've used WhatsApp. It's very, very quick and fast, and it marks it as different than a text or an email. Email is more cumbersome. But yesterday, for instance, they passed on a memo in this WhatsApp group, including Steve Kanellakis, including the mayor, including Alan Hubley and Manconi. And the memo was some kind of an update on testing, I believe. And they decided not to share the memo in this WhatsApp group. And they said, no, we're not going to forward that to commission. We're not going to basically reveal that. And the commission lawyer raising the facts, here you've got this small WhatsApp group making a key decision about a memo on an update on the largest infrastructure project in the city's history. And you're not going to disclose, and you're making those key decisions out of the public realm, out of the scrutiny of council, out of the scrutiny of transit commission. And it was clear where he was going with that. In their defense, they believe this was a discussion, and it's again, another reminder that, chats, texts, Facebook messages, whatever it is, if you're in public life, this can become part of a record and can be made to look like it's official communications, when I'm sure the principals were thinking this is just a back and forth conversation to, move things along. I'm sure they're not sitting there, Matt, thinking as we're talking in this WhatsApp chat, this is going to be viewed as official communication someday at a public inquiry, and we're going to be grilled about the fact that we're hiding things.
Right.
I'm sure it was more utilitarian, like this is an easy way to communicate, and here's how we tick the boxes, and here's, hey, what about this? What about that? Are we going to put this forward? But in this particular light, with this particular context, it does look, it's damaging because they weren't sharing that much information. The media wasn't getting nearly as much information as many of us wanted, and certainly council. I've heard that many times from council, that it was torturous to get any solid information out of RTG, out of transit, on what exactly was going on with the build and the testing.
Well, yeah, remember back in that September when they were doing the 12 days of testing, any questions we asked, it was impossible to get an answer, let alone anyone to come on and do an interview about it. That just wasn't going to happen.
And they would say, because the testing is so vigorous, they were obviously clearly not hitting their marks, and they didn't want to come on and say, because the first question is, how's it going? Well, it wasn't going very well.
Right.
So they didn't want to come on and say that. And so they put a cone of silence over the testing and then came out and said, we hit our marks, even though we reduced it to 9 instead of 12 days.
So the former RTG CEO, Peter Lauch, will testify today. We've got some city councilors, like you mentioned, Alan Hubley, Catherine McKenney, Diane Deans, the mayor tomorrow. So there's still a lot to watch here in the next couple of days.
Yes, and very quickly, I know you got to go. Caution here, I learned very early in my career, covering a very important criminal trial. I listened to the lawyers, defense, and Crown, and I thought I knew where the judge was going. We have no idea what the judge is thinking. We have no idea what evidence he is taking as serious and what he's going to write. Keep in mind, the commission lawyers are Mr. Adair yesterday, very aggressive, very strong, and very clear. But that is simply leading evidence, leading a story. And we'll see if the judge picks it up and what he accepts and what he doesn't accept.
Yeah, this thing's far from over. It's a good point to make. Graham, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
No problem, Matt.
Graham Richardson, CTV's chief anchor on the Ottawa Light Rail Transit Public Inquiry that got pretty interesting yesterday, and there's still a couple interesting days coming up today and tomorrow, so we'll keep you updated on that throughout the day and into tomorrow as well. It's the Morning Rush. Good morning. Doctor, how are you this morning?
I'm okay, Matt. How are you?
Pretty good. My allergies aren't that bad this year, and I threw it out there on the text board at 580-580, and we're getting a lot of people saying that theirs are really bad this year.
Yeah.
I don't know what to make of that. Is there, I guess there would be causes, like just more pollen in the air, but is there something to the fact that this may be a worse year than usual?
Well, in my neck of the woods, you come out in the morning and your car is coated with tree pollen. Look at the rivers on the Rideau. Water, you think it's algae, and then you get up close enough and you go, no, that's just pollen sitting on the water. So there does tend to be more pollen, and also earlier in the season. And again, I'm not a botanist. I have no expertise in trees and grasses and such, but the people that do are saying that the seasons are starting earlier. Climate change is having an effect on the cycle, the reproductive cycle of trees and grasses and such. And so you're seeing 20 days earlier now of pollen counts increasing and the concentration being a lot more. So there is some evidence that is what is happening. For people that are suffering with allergies, if you're getting, there are limitations to what the medication can do, right? So there are different medications to control seasonal allergies. But if the
should you consult a doctor before you take those, or can you just go buy them at the pharmacy and that should be good enough?
So there are certain medications you can buy over the counter, predominantly the antihistamines and non-sedating ones. So we're not talking about things like Benadryl, which can be sedating, not really recommended because of that. You don't want to take that and then drive your car. But at the same time, there are non-sedating ones and a whole slew of them, Claritin, Arius, Reactine. There's a whole bunch that you can take. And there are some newer generation prescription antihistamines. One is called Blexten, the other is called Rupall, that can be used as well to complement other medications that are prescribed. And the ones that are typically prescribed are the nasal steroid medications. And there's also nasal antihistamine and eye drops, antihistamine eye drops, Patanol is one of them, or it's called Pataday, that you can use for the eyes if you get very itchy eyes. And it's just a drop or two each day and works quite well. There are also anti-inflammatory eye drops. One is called diclofenac or Voltaren eye drops that can be used to reduce inflammation. If your eyelids get swollen or irritated, that can help. So there are a bunch of prescription medications that can help. But for the nose, there are medications, both oral medications and topical medications like the nasal sprays that can help. But ultimately, to control it, some people who have more severe disease or severe reactions have to be really deliberate in using their medications every day. And that's part of the issue too. Adherence to dosing can be difficult. People are busy, and it's not a criticism. It's very common to miss doses. And for certain medications, it's very important to be taking that every day to suppress the allergic response. And so for some people that may be experiencing more severe conditions, it might be because of where they are with regards to the pollen counts. It might be a combination of that and less adherence to their dosing schedule. When people start feeling better, they tend to use things less because they're feeling better. Can't blame them for that. But ultimately, you're feeling better because the medication is helping. Or again, the pollen counts are starting to go down. But right now, there is a lot of seasonal allergies that are going on, and that's creating a lot of hassle for people.
What is it that makes some people more susceptible to the allergic reactions than other people? Or you get three people dealing with pollen, well, you might have one with just, total swelling. The eyes are a problem. The nose is a problem. Someone like me who just deals with, it's uncomfortable. I sneeze a lot, but it's manageable, especially with the odd Claritin or whatever. And then some people just aren't affected at all. But what's the difference in our bodies?
It's a spectrum of reactions, right? For the same reason that you can have someone that's allergic to peanuts and may have just a rash. Another person may have an anaphylactic reaction where they can't breathe. So it's just a matter of the individual and how their body responds to allergens. Allergens are the proteins like pollen and such like that, that cause the reaction. And it's for that reason, when you think of people that are doing immunotherapy where they're getting allergy shots and they're becoming less sensitized to what causes their allergic reaction over time, because their body is being trained to not respond as severely to the various things that they're allergic to. And so, but that can happen innately as well, right? That can happen just in each individual can have a different level of response. And so that, whereas you may have less of a response, somebody else in the same situation might respond more strongly. And it's simply a factor of how your immune system responds to the allergen compared to somebody else's.
Is it random or genetic? Like, would your DNA have something to do with it, or is it just kind of luck of the draw?
I think for many, there is a genetic component. You tend to see if the parents have severe allergies, the children have an increased risk, and not guaranteed, but an increased risk of that. And again, our immune system is a programmable system and it comes from somewhere. And so if you have a genetic condition that increases your likelihood that you're going to respond and have severe allergic reactions, that certainly can get passed on to your offspring.
Yeah, it's a tough time of year, right? If you're dealing with it. So when should you go to get a prescription as opposed to just over the counter? Is it if the over the counter stuff isn't working for you, or are there times when there would be another reason to actually go to a doctor and get a prescription for this?
So it always boils down to quality of life, right? So if someone is just finding that it's interfering with their ability to function, they can't sleep well at night, their nose is getting really blocked up, eyes are itchy and watery, these are the typical symptoms that you have for seasonal allergies, then they probably would see your physician to look at various other medications, and especially if the over-the-counter ones are not cutting it for you. Usually, if you have a known history of that, and you know the allergy season is coming, usually you would start, for example, some of the nasal steroid sprays a couple of weeks before the season starts, just to give your body a head start to reduce the possibility of reacting.
And don't do like I do and just wait for the symptoms to be irritating and then take it.
Yeah, you want to be proactive.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for this, doctor. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're welcome, Matt. We'll go on.
Good morning, Ottawa. This is the Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
The Morning Rush. Good morning. Matt Harrison for Bill Carroll this week. It's Wednesday. He'll be back on Monday. And it's a short week because of Canada Day. So the more I follow this probe or inquiry into the mass shooting in Nova Scotia, but the more questions I have about potential political interference here. This story started to come down just over a week ago. And we talked about it when it happened. We talked about it on the show on Friday when Brian Lilly was on, because he's been covering a lot of that as well. But another detail came down yesterday, and a letter that had come down from an RCMP official raises some questions about political interference and what was going on right at the top of the RCMP here. So it was a letter from Leah Scanlon dated April 14, 2021, and it claims that the leader of the RCMP was more focused on the Liberals' gun bill in the story. So there was a news conference back on April 14th and of 2021. So we're talking about last year, about 14 months ago. And the RCMP official giving the update did not give any update on what guns were used in that shooting. And he had written some notes either before or after the press conference that were entered into evidence in that public inquiry, basically saying in there that the RCMP was concerned that if they provided information about the guns, that it would jeopardize their investigation, right? And so what comes down from this this person here, Leah Scanlon, who testified yesterday, they were saying that the commissioner of the RCMP had then phoned some of the key officers and made the point that they were getting pressure from the public safety minister to announce the types of guns that were being used as part of the gun legislation. Like, that becomes the allegation here. Scanlon said that Lucky, quote, informed us of the pressures and conversations with Minister Blair, who would be Public Safety Minister Bill Blair, which we clearly understood was related to the upcoming passing of gun legislation. I remember a feeling of disgust as I realized it was a catalyst for a conversation and perhaps a justification for what you were saying about us. That was a letter that was entered into the inquiry yesterday. Now, the former public safety minister, who's still a cabinet minister, one of his spokespeople wrote a statement to the Canadian Press yesterday and said the minister was regularly briefed following events in Nova Scotia, but was clear that any decision of what information to publicly disclose regarding any investigation, as with all operational matters, is taken slowly at law enforcement's discretion. But it's clear that some people at the RCMP believe that the commissioner wanted them to release the type of guns because of political pressure that they were getting from the federal government. And as many people have pointed out already, this government in the past hasn't been very upfront about other issues, right? Remember SNC-Lavalin and the Prime Minister coming out and saying the story in the Globe and Mail was false. And then months later we realized, well, every word of that seemed to be true. And so when members of the government come out here and say that the RCMP members who are now saying that there was political interference, they're wrong, kind of blown their credibility on a few other things before. There needs to be a separation of police investigation and government officials. It's one of the fundamental things that drives our police forces. And enough people have now come forward in this inquiry through either letters or testimony that gives me some doubt about what's going on here. We need some answers on this. Was there political interference, whether it be at the highest level, from the public safety minister, or from the head of the RCMP, towards the people investigating this, to push or to use as justification for a gun ban? And the more and more this inquiry continues out in Nova Scotia, I think it's those questions become louder and louder, and I haven't seen an answer that's quite all that satisfying on it yet. Have you? The more that this continues, the more questions I have about whether or not there was political interference at that level. And is it good enough, if there was, that Bill Blair is no longer the public safety minister? Do we need him out of cabinet or out as MP? And do we need a new commissioner of the RCMP? These are all valid questions that haven't been answered yet. And I think the coming days of this inquiry will be very interesting on that. It's 7:15, The Morning Rush.
You're listening to The Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
The Morning Rush. Good morning. It's clear that the COVID-19 situation is still with us. Just anecdotally, over the last couple of weeks, the amount of friends, family, and colleagues who have come down with COVID-19 in just like the last week or so is at a level that I haven't seen in a couple of months. And just, you know, I was looking at the COVID wastewater numbers, and it's clear that they've been on kind of an upward trajectory over the last few days. The 7-day rolling average and is clearly going up a little bit. And I'm not saying that to panic or even say that we need to be doing anything different than we already are, except for the fact, just to point out, that it's definitely there. And it's not totally going away. And one of the things that was interesting through a couple of the people that I had talked to was second infections coming in. The head of the Ontario Science Table warning us that this new Omicron subvariant BA.5 is expected to become the dominant strain in Ontario. Immunity from vaccination and prior infection much weaker against BA.5. We've got to figure out ways to deal with it, but it's just a reminder that it's still there. But, you know, it's interesting the way our whole mentality around this has shifted, right? Some people are using that as ways to say that, see, this thing isn't over. We need to double down on masking and gathering limits. No, that's, we've gone too far with that. We're at a point now where you see people who have COVID-19. If it happens in your workplace, it causes some scheduling issues. If it happens in your family, it causes just some logistical issues there. But the reality is that you're not worried that somebody's going to, you know, get sick so badly that they die anymore if they're a normally healthy, vaccinated person that gets it. And that's kind of just where we're at right now with this whole thing. So that's just to say that the numbers have been going up slightly over the last week or so. Anecdotally, that makes sense just based on what I'm there. Public officials are telling us that it's going to take this BA.5 variant, your vaccine and your natural immunity, it seems to still squeeze by you there. So just be aware that it's still kind of burning in the background there. Police out in BC are saying that three officers are suffering serious injuries. Three more were treated and released after being shot yesterday at a bank robbery. The chief constable out there is Dean Duthie. He said police were called middle of the day, 11 a.m. local time, because two armed suspects entered into the Bank of Montreal in the town.
Multiple officers responded to the scene and encountered the armed suspects who fired at police. Two suspects who were shot by police died at the scene.
He said the scene was chaotic, but luckily, as much as there were injuries of the police officers, there were nobody hurt who was just a general member of the public or anyone who worked at the bank. No injuries there.
There's three officers that are looking to be released from hospital probably in the next little while. The others that are undergoing surgery right now obviously have much more serious injuries. And at this point, I just can't comment on the extent or nature of them because it's ongoing.
At the time, they were worried about a potential third suspect as well.
It's not a confirmed third suspect, but we're taking all safety precautions necessary. We've asked all those areas around the bank incident to remain in their houses, lock their doors, what we call shelter in place. And we've taken all the necessary precautions to get the information out through media channels, through our social media, to keep the public up to date.
Since then, they've said that the shelter-in-place order is over and that they haven't found any other further indication of a potential third suspect. I guess they're still looking into that possible angle, but they've seen nothing since yesterday that would lead them to believe that that had happened. But massive police response there, as you would expect. And there's video floating around on social media as well of the bank robbery, just taken by someone who was really, depending on how you look at it, either right place, right time to get a video, or just wrong place, wrong time to be in the middle of all that, because it looked terrifying. And it was just a stream of officers running on foot, heading towards the bank and exchanging gunfire with the two suspects. So those two suspects dead out in BC yesterday. And no word of a third one yet, although police, for whatever reason, for at least a time yesterday, we're concerned that there might be. Out in BC yesterday as well, the premier of that province announcing that he was stepping down, wasn't going to be running again. So BC Premier John Horgan taking a step away from his job out there yesterday as well. It's the Morning Rush. We'll take a break. When we come back, a couple local stories. There was the multiple people who were killed in a stabbing yesterday in the South End, and recommendations put forward in the inquest into triple murder in the Ottawa Valley. And so we'll talk about both of those situations when we come back. It's the Morning Rush. You know, it's not the same as it was.
You're listening to The Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
The Morning Rush. Good morning. Matt Harrison for Bill Carroll. We got a lot more information yesterday about that stabbing in the south end of the city on Anoka Street. It's near Bank and Heron. And, you know, yesterday, really all we had was that three people had been stabbed. Two of them had died, and one person had been killed after an interaction with police. And we got a lot more information on it yesterday. The three people that were stabbed, it was three women, a woman and two of her daughters that were the victims here. Not entirely clear which two of them died and which one had survived. Then the other person that was shot by police was a man who was the suspect in that incident. The Special Investigations Unit says the man, when police got there, he was ordered to drop the knife and did not. Three officers discharged their guns and he died. But the woman that he was stabbing at the time that he was ordered to drop the weapon by police and was shot at, that woman was struck by a bullet as well. The SIU saying she has a non-life-threatening gunshot wound. In Ottawa, police had said that she had some pretty serious stab wounds, but just a lot to unpack there. What happened in that neighborhood at Bank and Heron. So that was Monday night. We found out about it kind of late Monday night, and we talked about it yesterday morning early. But that's kind of where we're at. Monica Hudden, the SIU spokesperson, provided an update with the latest information yesterday afternoon.
The preliminary information indicates that at approximately 10:30 p.m., a 911 call from a home on Anoka Street came in. And in that call, screaming could be heard, as well as information that someone had stabbed someone else. Police officers were dispatched to the scene. Upon arriving, they saw a man stabbing a woman in the roadway.
And then, like I said, apparently three officers discharged the gun. The suspect's dead. The woman who was being stabbed was also injured, non-life-threatening gunshot wound, so she was shot as well. A neighbor that lived nearby, a person named Les, didn't want to use their last name, said he knew the family.
I would see them three or four times a day, you know, coming and going. It is unexplainable. I would never think it would be someone in the neighborhood. I thought it would be outsiders from another part of the city, but I never thought it would be somebody one house away.
Said at the time it was a chaotic scene.
I thought it was fireworks, kids, and then I heard six or eight shots in very quick succession, and then all the police cars and all the lights arrived within minutes.
There's another witness that said they just heard a bunch of screaming, then saw the police lights, then heard gunshots, and it was all very quick in the neighborhood, but that's what we were dealing with in the South End this morning. So like I said, a lot more information came out yesterday, and pretty graphic details there as well. The jury in the coroner's inquest into the death of three women in the Ottawa Valley issued its recommendations yesterday, recommending that Ontario formally declare intimate partner violence as an epidemic and establish an independent commission dedicating to eradicating it. Now, it came after the deaths of Carol Culleton, Natalie Warmerdam, and Anastasia Cusack, and focused on the dynamics of gender-based violence. Kristen Mercer, counsel to the End Violence Against Women in Renfrew County, participated in the inquest and says the 86 recommendations issued by the jury are thoughtful.
This jury is screaming, and they're screaming on behalf of the families who we acknowledge. They're screaming on behalf of the women whose voice is lost or silenced by the fear and the violence they live with. And perhaps importantly, they're screaming on behalf of all of us.
Became obvious following that inquiry that some pretty obvious steps were missing. One of the things that had come out was that the guy, Basil Baruski, who ended up killing these three women, had been ordered into some kind of domestic abuse therapy program. And nobody stopped to really think about the fact that this therapy spot, which he said he wasn't going to go to anyway, but the location of it was right across the street from where the woman worked. And so, you know, you've got so many red flags there, right? The fact that he says he's not going to do it, the fact that he had threatened about killing people before, the fact that it's right across the street from her workplace and nobody seemed to care about that. Pamela Cross, a lawyer and expert on violence against women who was involved in the inquest, highlighted the recommendation specifically to declare it an epidemic.
This is an epidemic. It deserves to be called an epidemic. It's a public health crisis in this country.
Kind of became obvious throughout following this, and I guess this was one of the things that they were looking to establish by doing it, was that many small towns just maybe don't have the full resources to deal with a problem like that, let alone, you know, the stigma and everything else around it. Valerie Warmerdam, whose mother Natalie was one of the victims, says she took part in the inquest because she wanted to see change.
These recommendations are a good start if they're actioned. It's a big if.
The recommendations, right? They're not binding. That's one of the things going on about it. But you hope after this much time and public resources was put into something like this, that it doesn't just become something that's thrown away and becomes a waste of your time. We haven't had to look far in this city to see examples of that type of violence. This was obviously a worst case scenario, but they rear up from time to time for sure. So something needs to be done. And like I said, 86 recommendations. And we'll see if any of them are acted on. Declaring it an epidemic would probably be a massive step. Is that totally necessary? I don't know. I'm not the experts on that. But these people sat and listened to the testimony and think that's something that needs to be done. So that's kind of where we're at this morning. It's coming up on 7:45 here, the Morning Rush. I'm Matt Harris in for Bill Carroll. Good morning. All right. I'm hosting the show this week for Bill Carroll, which means Corey Price is here and you're planning a trip to a winter destination. What do we have here?
Yeah, so if you are interested in winter sports, if that's kind of your preference, but you're frustrated that it's the end of June, we're in the thick of summer, maybe that's how you want to spend Canada Day, on the slopes instead, there is a place you can go to do that today. If you can get to Banff, Alberta, you could go ski at the Sunshine Village in Banff today. There is snow still on the ground on the mountain. The melt was late in the season, and there was a lot of snow in the winter. And people are out skiing and snowboarding in, like, swimsuits and shirtless. And people are just out there doing whatever. And it's a really, like, bizarre kind of sight to see. I am just trying to make sure I know what order my clips are in. I was looking to pull that up. And so, yeah, people have been talking about just how weird it is to be skiing at the end of June.
One. This is like the best experience that I've ever had. So I'm like, especially during the summer. So I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
I think it's an amazing opportunity. Like, if you can make it, like, just make it, because maybe you won't have the chance in this life.
Oh, this honestly feels like true Canadian spirit. Like, this is true Canada right now.
People say the strangest things.
People are just saying
stuff.
They've
got a camera in front of their face, right?
But yeah, so this hasn't happened since 1991. I didn't realize that this is something that could have happened in 1991 even. But if you...
Well, they usually have snow fairly late into the year. Like, yeah. not end of June, but like early May, it's not uncommon for them there to be some kind of snow.
Yeah, and then Kendra Scherfield works at the Banff Sunshine Village. She was talking about just that it's weird to see people out so late.
I think staff think it's pretty surreal, pretty cool. It's tripping some people out.
I could see that, tripping some people out. Also, what a very like Banff ski chalet way to put that. But 500 people were there yesterday skiing and snowboarding. And
amazing.
My favorite guy who was there is is this guy who traveled from Winnipeg, but I'll let him explain what the process was like because he just couldn't wait. He needed to get there to ski as early as possible.
My flight was $1,400. Flew here yesterday just to be here today because, like, it's a once in a lifetime to snowboard in the summer.
$1,400 flight from Winnipeg.
Gotta do what you gotta do.
Got there next day and, or got there day before he was gonna go and just was like, I can't wait. I need to go now. And he, just so everyone knows, yes, he was skiing shirtless and shorts.
But, you know, he's lucky in a way, not so much for getting to be out in the summer.
Right.
Skiing and doing what he likes to do. But the main issue for him is he's just lucky that they didn't cancel his flight after he spent $1,400 or lost his skis.
Yeah, he definitely took some gambles. And if you're planning on trying to make this out before they run out of the snow or have to close, they are hoping to be open all the way until July 3rd. And they intend to be open on Canada Day. There will be DJs and like restaurants open and people will be, you know, snowboarding and skiing July 1st. Like nothing's going on. Like it's just the thing that you do.
I can already see the reaction now. So much for your global warming hoax now,
look
right?
Look at all this snow.
Look at all the snow, yeah.
If you're wondering the reason for this, it's called La Nina, like the weather phenomenon. It just meant that more snow, colder later. And though a meteorologist had said that it usually leaves more snowpack on mountains than you would necessarily have in an average year. So that's why it was sticking around.
Ski down in the bathing suit, get to the beach, get to the bottom.
Yeah, ski straight to the beach.
Jump on in. It's fantastic. It's the Morning Rush. Good morning. And if you can't be
next to me, your memory. You're listening to The Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
It's Matt Harrison for Bill Carroll this morning and for the rest of the week, The Morning Rush. Was reading this report from Aviva Insurance, Aviva Canada, and they were saying it's called the How We Live Report. And it just had a lot of fascinating things about the way the pandemic has kind of shifted our lives. Through polling that was done for them, they talked to people about how they're spending their money, what they did during the pandemic, things that they bought. Where they're living. And there's a lot of interesting data to dive into here. One of the ones that I guess stood out to me is 6 in 10 people who moved blame the pandemic as the reason they moved. But now that, you know, things are starting to open up, do they want to go back to the office? How are they going to get there? Did they really think it through that they're just going to start driving even further throughout the pandemic here? A lot of interesting stuff to dig into. Phil Gibson's the Executive Vice President and Managing Director of Personal Insurance at Aviva Canada and is on the line right now. Phil, thanks for being here this morning. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Matt. It's great to be here.
A lot of really interesting stuff here, but let's start with, I guess, people that moved during the pandemic. Many people blaming COVID for it and saying when it comes time to go back to work, they're just going to drive even further into the office.
They might, or they might be finding different ways of working, right? That's some of the other things we've found is that some are going to work from home, some are going to do hybrid working, and yeah, some are going to commute longer distances, but in a more rural environment.
Sort of broke down, probably predictably, I think, based on people's age, whether or not they want to go back to the office, didn't it?
It did. And I was a little surprised, I got to admit, the younger folks, the 35 to 44, who were feeling like it was stressful, they were less likely to go in. And then I don't want to call them older, but more middle-aged and
there you
senior
go.
Folks, you know, were more likely to want to return to the office. And maybe that's habit, right? Maybe that's what we've known our whole careers. So maybe it's something we're more accustomed to.
As people, make that commute in and see if they move further away from the office, they've got a bit of a longer commute on us. Have we prepared ourselves for just the increased traffic that's going to be out on roadways and in cities like here in Ottawa?
You know, I don't know, Matt. I know a lot of folks are listening to this in their cars and they're thinking traffic is just unacceptable right now. I don't I don't know how government responds to this. I don't know how city planners or traffic planners respond to it. But I think what's important is we put the information out there so that people can respond to it. We're transparent with this information and share it and really get the word out on what Canadians are doing as a result of COVID.
And it would seem to me that if you live even further away from the office, you're probably less likely to take things like public transit in, right? People that live further away tend to be the ones that are in their vehicles. Is that a good read on the situation?
I think that's an accurate read on the situation, Matt, because there's less options, right? In a more urban environment, you might have more public transportation options, typically, and in a rural setting, you may have less, right? So they may be forced into commuting when they need to go into the office.
Saw interesting ways through this report, even in the ways people spent their money during the pandemic, and a lot of people spending. I read the most popular thing was the backyard. If people were buying stuff for the home, because I guess they realize that can't quite escape for a vacation, you may as well make the backyard your vacation spot.
Yeah, you do the staycation, right? You stay and you make your own living space more enjoyable, and that includes extending it out into the backyard. We saw a lot of that. And of course, with that, I wouldn't be a good insurance guy if I didn't point out, like, a lot of that brings on potentially new risk, and you want to make sure you're covered for that, right?
Things like pools and trampolines and things that people can get hurt in.
Exactly. You have more kids, more people coming into your house. You're doing different things than originally. You just want to make sure you're covered for that so that in the event of, you know, something terrible happens, you're well covered.
Yeah, I guess you just don't want to be caught. Being caught without it is a terrible situation, so you want to call in. Was there anything that really surprised you? I mean, there's a lot of information here to go through, and I found those ones interesting, but was there something for you that really stood out as either surprising or really interesting?
I think for me, just that, as you cited it right at the top, right? 6 in 10 who moved said they moved because of COVID-19. That is a large number of folks who were impacted. You know, we always thought it was impacting in ways of just the health was the primary impact, but that people have chosen where they want to live next based on this pandemic. It was just fascinating.
I guess in a way, when you stop and take a step back and think about that, it makes some sense, right? If I was living in a downtown condo pre-COVID, like, there's a lot of amenities. You're close to a lot of bars and restaurants and public gathering spaces, and it's easy to get to a concert. And all of a sudden we get into this lockdown where suddenly none of that stuff's available for you, and you're looking at a very small walls and maybe a nice balcony, and things that would have been an advantage just a few months before all of a sudden kind of became a liability. And if you can get out into the suburbs, maybe we talked about backyards just now, that it does make some sense when you stop and take a look at it.
It does. And we're seeing that even with our own workforce here. It's a lot of our younger folks are taking that advantage of getting out, getting their first home. A lot of them, it's their first home, and getting more space.
Who are you targeting with this information? Is it public planners who would have to adapt to our new way of life? Is it people who are in management trying to see how their workplace adapts to it? Because you got a lot of very interesting information that can be helpful for a lot of people, but who are you targeting it to?
We want to go as broad as we can with this. I think anyone who can use this information to make better decisions based on facts versus, you know, it's easy to make an anecdote based on the things you or I might see on the way to work or that we might see out in the evening if we go to a restaurant. But I think it's important to put good information out there. We try to make evidence-based decisions around here. So I think that's important. It could be city planners. It could be government. It could be private industry. We're happy to share it. Mostly, we want our customers and consumers out there to think, when we make these decisions, I want to make sure I'm well covered, right? We want everyone to know and feel certainty around their decisions.
A lot more first-time homebuyers this time around than the last time you guys did that survey too, which kind of goes against this idea that the real estate market is so far out of reach for people. There were a lot more first-time homebuyers this time around than the last time you did it.
That was another surprising fact. Yeah, I was shocked to see that as well. And I, you know, people ask why. I don't have a why on that one other than I think, you know, we talked about it earlier, people wanting to make that leap perhaps to a more space, more living, more outdoor living space. But yeah, it was kind of a surprising stat that continues.
Well, a lot of different things to chew on there for decision makers or just for people who are kind of interested in what their neighbors and friends may have been doing. I dug into a lot of these things. I mean, we moved during a pandemic, wouldn't have blamed it on COVID necessarily. It was more just, you know, family considerations. But that was the stat, like you, for me, that really caught me off guard. But thanks for digging into some of those with us. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, man. Happy to do it.
Bill Gibson, the Executive Vice President and Managing Director of Personal Insurance at Aviva Canada. So yeah, 6 in 10 people who moved during the pandemic said it was directly related to the COVID pandemic. Yeah, younger people less enthusiastic about going back to the office than people who are over the age of 45. It ties in directly with people that have younger kids not wanting to go back into the office. And it wasn't dug into so much in this survey as other surveys that I was diving into based on this, but there's have been other reports of a shocking number of people who are just ready to walk away from their job completely if they're called back into the office. And I just question how people are able to make that move. When you see inflation at the rates that it's at and so many people living paycheck to paycheck, or even if it's not paycheck to paycheck, are you really comfortable with just quitting a job because you don't like those specific working conditions? And so I question that part of, like I said, it was a different report, not this one. I question that specific number just based on, okay, it's easy to talk tough, right? And say, okay, yeah, if they call me back, I'm quitting. And then you're actually called back and you realize, hey, I sort of have to pay my bills and I don't really have a chance here. I'm going back. But not a surprise the way it broke down for me based on age there, and that younger people were way more likely to not like the idea of going back to the office. It's the Morning Rush. Good morning. I'm Matt Harrison for Bill Carroll.
News Talk 580 CFRA's $1,000 Minute. Brought to you by Alpine Credits. Homeowners get approved.
All right, we're going to Barrhaven. Eric's on the line. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Matt.
Ready to win $1,000?
I hope so.
I hope so, too. So we're going to ask you 10 questions in a minute. Everyone you get right is $10. You get all 10, you get $1,000, and you have to answer the question that you were asked. Is that clear?
Yes.
All right, sounds good. We'll start the clock after I finish reading the first question. Which messaging app was used by some city officials to share LRT updates?
What app group?
How many business days has Daisy been waiting for her passport?
60.
What's the forecasted high temperature for Canada Day?
Canada Day 28.
What's been banned by Airbnb?
Airbnb has banned the, the party.
There you go. How many people took part in summer skiing in Banff yesterday?
How many people? 500.
Name the RCMP commissioner.
The RCMP commissioner. Oh, that's a good one. Pass.
What time this morning did the downtown vehicle control zone open?
8 a.m.
And which day next week will it end?
Monday.
Name the premier that said they will not run for re-election.
Horgan.
Who do the Red Blacks play tomorrow?
BC.
And name the RCMP commissioner.
The RCMP commissioner, oh my God. Ganlin?
Okay, you got an answer in there. Let's see how you did. How do you feel?
I don't know if Scanlon, Commissioner, or CMP.
That one threw you for a bit of a loop there.
That
right?
Got tense.
All right. Well, Corey's going to run through them. We'll save that one for the end because it was the last question we asked you there, Eric, and we'll see how you did.
Yeah. So we got some LRT updates for city officials being shared on which app? You said WhatsApp. That's right. How many business days has Daisy been waiting for her passport? You said 60, that's right. What's the forecast high for Canada Day? You said 28, that's right. Airbnb has banned what from its homes? You said parties, that's right. How many people took part in summer skiing in Banff yesterday? You said 500, that's right. At what time this morning did the downtown vehicle control zone open? You said 8 a.m., that's correct. What day next week will that end? You said Monday, also correct. Name the premier that said they would not run in their next election. You said John Horgan, that's right. Who do the Red Blacks play on tomorrow, on Thursday? You said the Lions, that's right. And we've got the last question here. maybe for $1,000, we ask you to name the RCMP commissioner. You said Scanlon. It's Brenda Luckey.
Oh.
Leah Scanlon wrote the memo that was presented to the RCMP commission yesterday.
Oh.
Oh, man.
But that's a really good 9 out of 10 showing. You were on it.
We stumped you on one of them, Eric, but you blew through the rest of them. That was fantastic.
Thanks.
Congratulations. Thanks. Eric in Barrhaven, $90. You can tell he's like, oh, that's a good one. Yeah, that was the plan. That's, we stumped you, I guess, a little bit. I really wanted that guy.
Yeah,
to get
$1,000.
Oh, man, so close. All right, so we'll talk about the WhatsApp group. At least one member of the team is a bit concerned about the Airbnb party ban based on just summer plans. It's more than 16 people can't be in the same home. Now, they said they would make exceptions. They talked specifically about, I guess, you can, some of their European properties, you can rent castles. And they're like, well, obviously, you can have more.
You
than
can fit a lot of
people
in a castle.
They even mentioned island cottages on there. So you never know. So for anyone who may have heard that and got a bit concerned, vineyards in the U.S., large beachfront. They didn't say islands, they said large beachfronts. But, you know.
What is an island if not a large beachfront?
Exactly. It's that by definition is a large beachfront. So 16 people is the party limit, but they say they'll make some exceptions. I don't know how you enforce that. I don't even know if the success that they say that they got out of that. They said that they saw almost a 50% decrease in parties during the pandemic. I think that might just be the fact that there was a pandemic and just fewer people out partying. But what do I know? Airbnb says their limit is now 16 people. It's the Morning Rush. Good morning.
You're listening to the Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
So there's a company called Data Wazo, I guess it's called. It's the Morning Rush, by the way. Good morning, Matt Harrison for Bill Carroll. They track airplane delays and coming out of all the major airports in our country and how many flights have been delayed and how many have been canceled outright. And just looking at so far, just from yesterday, 5% of flights at Ottawa were canceled, 21% delayed. Not great, but it could be worse. Pearson obviously had way higher number of flights. 22% of the flights at Pearson were canceled, 54% delayed. In Montreal, it was 25% canceled, 43% delayed. So we're seeing a big number. Now in Calgary, 100% of flights delayed. But there were only 4 flights, so let's not get too worked up about that going on. But it sounds like when you break down some of the data, like just based on yesterday alone, 1 in 4 flights out of Montreal canceled. It's not a great batting average, is it? It's not really the best record going on there. Most people are just at a point now where when they're traveling out of major airports that they're just expecting the worst from their flights, no matter where it is. But this one, you can go kind of by city, you can go by day, and lots of cancellations at major airports in and around our country. It's the Morning Rush. Good morning. Matt Harrison for Bill Carroll. We'll check the inbox here and see what you have to say before we end the show.
Now, the inbox. Everybody's talking about on News Talk 580 CFRA.
All right. So, plenty of hate mail coming in there. And not going to waste a lot of time on all of your pro-convoy tweets. I mean, you want to come in there and, you know, just spew a bunch of anti-vax hatred, which it's funny. You got a few numbers that just sort of take up this whole thing, and I got to scroll through all of that stuff. But here we go. How many people do you think were on the committee to come up with the name Motor Vehicle Control Zone? Now, give them a bit more credit than that. There wasn't more than like 6 or 7 people on a committee to come in there. My allergies are normally fine. I can usually pop a pill and be done with it. And this year, they are terrible. I'm popping pills like crazy. This guy says, you don't read my texts anymore, which is lame. So let's dive into what else did he say? All right. Was there any consultation with Vancouver, BC, or Calgary Transit? Maybe the stuck-up pressured yuppies here didn't think about that, eh? You start to wonder, as you see all the delays mounting with Ottawa Transit. Like, was there any kind of consultation with any other cities going on there? Don't we know that we used trains that weren't tested for this type of weather and that kind of situation? So there are definitely some questions of, were we actually consulting with anybody, or just taking the absolute cheapest thing out there? So that committee will continue tomorrow. It's the Morning Rush. Matt Harrison for Bill Carroll. We'll take a break here. I guess we should find out together who is hosting the show that's coming up next. And we'll check this thing out here. Ottawa at Work with Andrew Pinson coming up next.